This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Buddhist teacher Sharon Salzberg and Buddhist scholar Robert Thurman. He is professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies at Columbia University, and she's co-founder of the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts. Download the MP3 of that produced show with Robert Thurman and Sharon Salzberg at onbeing.org.
Hello.
Hello.
Totally all over Hollywood.
Sharon?
Hi.
Hi, it's Krista.
Oh, hello.
Oh, people are there?
Yes.
Yes.
Our host is here. One people is here.
Hi, Krista.
Hi. It's great to talk to you again.
Oh, it's great to talk to you as well.
Yeah. And
how are you, Chris?
I'm good. Bob, I don't think you'll remember this, but a trip that His Holiness the Dalai Lama made to Minneapolis like 12 years ago maybe, when I was just starting to pilot this radio show that eventually became a national program. And I sat down with you, I think in some hotel lobby here in Minnesota. So I have met you before.
But, wow. How long ago was that?
It was a long time ago. It was, I think it was maybe the year 2000, actually.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, anyway.
Actually, can you turn up the volume for the mic a little bit? I'm a slightly hard of hearing. And I can tell when you talk quickly, it will be hard to hear you.
Okay. I think, Chris, did you hear that? I think that's going to be at your end that they need to turn up the volume.
Okay. Yeah. I just turned it up in our headphones.
Okay.
A little more in my headphone, if possible.
Yeah. You can.
For extra.
Okay.
A little extra.
So, Krista, before I forget, Jeff Walker asked me to say hello to you.
Oh, my gosh. That guy is everywhere.
He's everywhere.
And the world gets smaller all the time.
He asked me in Santa Fe. We were in Santa Fe together,
so
and he
strange.
Asked me.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
He is everywhere. He's very cute.
Okay, I never mind. Okay, great.
Well, I just have gotten to know. I mean, I've actually never met him. We've been corresponding this year, but then there are all these tentacles that keep coming back at me.
It's true. It's true.
And you and I mean, I feel like I've spoken with you over the years, although we've never actually used our voices to do that.
Right. That's true.
So how are we, nice. Chris? How are we for?
We're close. I'd just love to have.
Okay, I don't want to. Let's let me ask you some.
I can hear it now.
Let me ask you a mundane question, but just to get some levels. Tell me, each of you, what you had for breakfast.
Oh, let's see. I had some cereal with some coconut milk and some figs.
Oh, okay.
Figs and cereal. Good for you. I had special mix that I make with fruit. And one of those, like, powders that has all these vitamins in it.
Yeah.
So I don't eat a regular breakfast and a cup of tea.
All right. So you are both
because
virtuous.
One meal a day. I just went all over Russia, Mongolia, being fed all kinds of weird food. And I didn't gain any weight. So I'm very pleased by skipping a meal.
Did you stay healthy?
I think so.
In Mongolia?
Yeah, sure. You know, all they have is meat, morning, noon, and night. You know, mm-hmm. Mutton is the
really?
Thing.
Really?
Oh, yeah. The Mongolians and are heavy meat. In general, in Europe, they're all into their cold cuts and their meat.
Yeah.
The veg thing is slowly coming. There's a few vegetarian restaurants actually in Mongolia, which is incredible.
Really?
Yeah. But basically, they're into, I mean, they're herders, you know, they're nomads.
Right.
Used to eating their sheep.
Oh. Well, you know, I'd like to start where I start all my conversations, and I probably asked you this question all those years ago, Sharon, but I just want to hear a little bit about, you know, I want to focus on with you as we speak is this teaching and thinking you're doing about enemies in the broadest sense of how we approach that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to start with just a little bit about whether there was a spiritual background to your childhood, and also whether, you know, in your earliest life, you know, how language and a sense of enemies was present for you, spiritually or otherwise.
No, that's very interesting. I don't know that there was a spiritual presence in my earliest life. There was certainly the presence of a lot of suffering and confusion.
Yeah.
And out of that, I really reached for something that I actually did sense always, not that it was given unto me, but I always had a sense there was something other, there was something bigger than the situations I found myself in. And, you know, my childhood was marked by a lot of disruption, a lot of loss. My mother died when I was very young. And all of this was surrounded by a very strange kind of silence. No one would ever actually talk about anything. And so it was when I went to college and I first encountered the Buddha's teaching in an Asian philosophy course, ironically, which I honestly think I chose just because it was like on Tuesday or something. That's where I first heard the Buddha saying, there's suffering in life. It's not just you. You don't have to feel aberrant and alone and weird. It's a part of life and you belong. And that was an enormous opening for me. And then I heard that you can do something about that suffering, not the kind of, you know, suffering of circumstance. It doesn't mean everything's always going to be pleasant or it's going to level off into this delightful place. But we can be different with everything. We can approach everything in a different way with a full heart and with wisdom. And that possibility is what sent me off to India.
And Bob, how about you? Was there a spiritual background to your childhood, and was there a sense or a vocabulary of enemies?
I'm not sure. I didn't have quite such a dramatic situation as Sharon did. My parents survived, although they both died fairly young, 50s and 60s, which to me is fairly young now. My mother's spiritual thing was Shakespeare, and she felt Shakespeare was the Buddha. And my father did have a little bit mystical side in relation to some of the French and Italian and Spanish Catholic thinkers, but he was not a Catholic, and we weren't church-going particularly. And I remember just feeling that I was kind of a little bit like a stranger in a strange land. It was my youth, because everybody was – my mother was an actress – and there was a lot of theater in the house, I felt, you know, a lot of emotional Sturm und Drang on and off. And I was like the peacemaker, and, you know, it seemed to me like, why are they getting so wound up, all this kind of thing. I didn't like God much. I liked Jesus. I thought he was very sweet. And his whole scene about, you know, every bird and the lilies of the valley and the Sermon on the Mount, I liked that. But then God was behind the scenes there, like, you know, sacrificing him. And I mean, I just thought that was weird. And I didn't believe in his omnipotent creatorship at all. And that was put me into a debate mode with the pastor in the place where I went to play basketball and sing on the brick church on Park Avenue. And then on the science side, I was into science. But on the science side, they also had their severe dogmatisms and limitations, which I didn't like. And so I was kind of felt myself like out of place in the American society, although I did my best to compete within it. And I, you know, I got good grades and I did whatever up to my teenage years. But until I discovered yoga, spirituality, and particularly, I like Sufism, actually. I like Christian mystics. Mm. I like some of the Swami mystics. But it was really with the Buddha who really got to me. Hmm. And in the Tibetan form, when I finally found the Tibetans,
right,
that really did to me. Although one funny thing, I wasn't that into Tibet per se. I was really into India. Hmm. But the thing is that the Indian Buddhist great revolution in the world, great manifestation in the world, is preserved in Tibet very powerfully.
Right, right.
And lost in India, you know. So right. I that was, I think, why I was so captivated by the Tibetans, not to mention the Dalai Lama's personality and so on.
And how did the two of you come to be doing these workshops and teachings together on this subject of enemies? Is there a story there?
I don't know how that happened yet. How did it happen?
Well, Bob and I are old friends. Bob, before he was at Columbia, was at Amherst College. And the center that I co-founded, the Insight Meditation Society, is in Barre, Massachusetts, which is about, say, 40, 45 minutes away from Amherst. And so I remember Bob living in this big yellow house, and these were the days when the Dalai Lama would come to visit, and as I'm told, you know, wander around Bob's house, opening up closet doors and saying things like, oh, very messy.
Untidy.
You know, and so we got to be friends then. He was raising his family and was a professor, And we kept trying to cook up things to do together, like, what could we possibly do here in the Pioneer Valley in Massachusetts? And then Bob came to New York City, Columbia, and eventually they established this gorgeous retreat center called Menla Mountain Center in Phoenicia, New York. And we began teaching there together, and we began teaching this particular workshop together because we come from two different strands of Buddhist tradition, and yet we enjoy, I think we both enjoy really exploring the relevance of these teachings to modern life, really, as we find it.
Right, right.
Right.
And I think what's so, such an important starting point is this reality base that I so love in Buddhism, right? Is even talking about something as painful and contentious as enemies, and really starting with the fact that that everything is always constantly changing, even things that are good, and that in life there will be suffering and we will be harmed, and so that this is a reality, not something that you begin by wishing away. Or, I mean, you know, you have to work with it, right?
Right.
Well, I mean, I think that's exactly right, and we face it. We find inner enemies. We find outer enemies. We make things of life, like death or suffering, enemies. Life is complicated. It's challenging. It's wonderful. It's all of that. And sort of trying to pretend that that won't happen, that we're just going to be perfectly content all of the time and not face these challenges is completely unreal. And I think it's much more important, obviously, and much more powerful to start with what's real.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Not only start with, but I think that nowadays when people ask me what is the essential, your essential sort of one phrase description of Buddhism, I always like to say Buddhism is engaged realism. Because the Buddhist tradition doesn't say that the Buddha met God and God had the answer, or that Buddha discovered that God knew what was going on and he didn't, this kind of thing. They say that Buddha himself discovered the nature of reality, completely understood it, fully and totally, and also understood that other beings could do so, and also understood that only by such discovery can you find freedom from that suffering. If you really know the reality, then you will be free of the suffering, was his real innovative teaching, which has lasted now for thousands of years.
Yeah.
So realism, being realistic, is the key, you know.
And I do want to kind of go through the way you unfold this subject of enemies. So, you know, in a sense, all of this thinking about enemies circles back to inner work. But let's start with the reality of outer enemies, as you say. I mean, those others who make our lives difficult. You know, one of the things, Bob, that you've written is, it is highly rational for us to love our enemies, which I think puts two things together, rationality and love of enemies, which is an interesting juxtaposition. What do you mean by that? What do you mean by that?
Well, Jesus is the one who used that phrase.
Yeah, but it's the hardest teaching.
Most prominently in our memory. Yes. Although Buddha used the same phrase, actually, in a slightly different phrasing. As far as we know, of course, we don't know exactly what any of those ancient people actually really said.
Yeah.
It's all transmitted through different people's writings and whatever. But I'm sure they said something in that vein. And Buddha said that hatred will never come to an end by hatred. Only love can overcome hatred, is what he said. Although usually in that tradition, the Burmese or Theravada tradition, the Buddhists have a midway station where they talk about hatred, and the next step is non-hatred. And then once you got non-hatred going, you can move over toward love and compassion.
I think that's useful. I think that's really useful.
It is. They're very psychologically astute about that sort of thing, I totally think.
Yeah.
But the reason why it's rational in a Buddhist sense is that the Buddhist worldview is that we live in a much larger continuity than a single lifetime. We've all had infinite previous lifetimes, and we've all will have infinite future lifetimes. And I would, and Mahayana Buddhists, I think, would argue, and maybe ultimately Theravada would agree, that that will be endless also, the future. It's just that once you attain enlightenment or nirvana, then it'll be blissful endlessness rather than a painful one. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's a very big motivation to attain nirvana, actually. Who wants an endless painful existence? Mm-hmm. Nobody. So within that, hatred or anger at anybody for whatever reason changes the quality of your life. And it predisposes you to forms of life that are unpleasant and a state of, and they reinforce your tendency to be in conflict and competition with others. And so even if you win one round in one life over one enemy, then you have become like that enemy by being violent, angry, whatever it may be. And then your rebirth will become something more appropriate to an inner state of anger and violence and hatred. And therefore, you'll be more in conflict with your environment and with others. So therefore, to love the enemy is highly rational from your own inner perspective in that sense. And actually, in the outer perspective, if you take the definition of love as wishing for the happiness of the beloved, which is the Buddhist definition of it, then if your enemy was really happy, he might get tired of bothering, he or she might get tired of bothering to be your enemy.
Okay.
Like, why bother chasing that guy? You know, I'm having a groovy time over somewhere else. So in a way, it's kind of makes sense to wish the enemy to be happy, but even on that level.
So,
but it's a little bit of a stretch. If you only live this one life from birth to death, it's a stretch, I agree. Mm-hmm. And at one point, we thought of putting a question mark after the title, like, love your enemies?
Yeah. Right.
Just to be provocative.
It is reasonable when you put it in that kind of framework. But, something that I think about a lot is that I think, you know, say in Christianity, this is often discussed as there's the problem of evil or, you know, great enemies. And even maybe in our culture, we tend to focus on these dramatic, you know, drama-sized enemies, you know, the Bernie Madoff or the bully or the catastrophic danger or the murderer. But, you know, something that I'm aware of in real life, day to day, I think so much pain and suffering is caused by, I don't know what I would even call maybe the near outer enemy, right? Not the villain out there, but the people close to us, you know, in workplaces or in families or in friendships. I don't know, Sharon, I think I remember that in your early life, you know, you said that your mother died, that you were in different foster families. And I mean, it's like people are vulnerable. And it's those people who have a power, such a destructive power to do damage in those circumstances. And that's where I feel like, you know, in the real life, as you say, Bob, in this lifetime, kind of the rubber meets the road. So, I mean, where do these beautiful teachings start to speak there?
Well, actually, I wasn't in foster families, but I was in different family configurations.
Oh, okay. All right.
I tried to calculate it once, and I think I was in five different family configurations when I left college at the age of 16.
Right.
But I think that's so crucial. I want to say something about that middle place, learning to stop hating. Apart from, because the word love is so loaded, and what does it mean? Our fear, of course, is that it means something very passive and complacent, and I'm going to let people hurt me, and I'm going to let them oppress other people, and I'm going to be a doormat. And it's a very nuanced and subtle quality. It's very hard to see love as a force, as a power, rather than as a weakness, but that is its reality. So that middle place is very compelling, whether it's a colleague at work who's sort of annoying or it's somebody who disappoints us just in the neighborhood or our community, or it's the villain to have some recognition that the way we can be consumed by hatred or even just an obsession, you know, that that habit we can have of going over someone's faults again and again and again. It's the same list, but we'd like to go over it again, you know, a few more times. And the way we give over so much of our energy to someone else in this kind of negative or destructive way. And, you know, whether it's a minor annoyance or a very grave injustice, there's a way in which we want to be whole. And we don't want to have lost so much of our life's energy to someone else's actions or problems. And we want that energy to return to us. And and for us to be able to go on in a more creative, generative way. And that's the process. That's why people engage in this process.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, so what do you mean? What? Tell me the process. Describe that.
Well, I think first being aware of how it actually feels to be frightened, to be so angry, to be so consumed with somebody else, to be able to see those states, to be able to have a little more distance or space from those states.
To just gain some self-awareness about the fact that you are going over and over that and letting it consume
you. Yeah,
that
exactly.
Way.
And how it feels, because then we want to let go out of the greatest compassion for ourselves, not because we're trying to be a goody-goody or a certain kind of person or meet a, you know, kind of image of how we're supposed to be or match, you know, someone else's dictum of how we're supposed to be, but out of the greatest love and compassion for ourselves, we just don't want to do that anymore.
Right. Bob, what are you thinking
well,
about this?
Well, my feeling about it is that, yes, that, and why I'm thrilled to have this book imply a link between Buddha and Jesus, which is mainstream in our culture, showing their commonality, is that Jesus' own statement of, you know, love thine enemies is negated, really, by our modern materialistic psychology. In other words, mm-hmm. the modern psychology says, oh, that's unrealistic. Freud said, oh, that's unrealistic. You have to have, you know, you have to be more normal. You have to love your enemies. Some saint maybe can do it, but we don't even know if there are any saints because, after mm-hmm. all, they are dragging around that unconscious with them. The unconscious, you know, the id with its id and its eros and thanatos and the whole thing.
Yeah.
And there's aggression and hostility. And so our sort of militaristic society's working psychology is that you have to be ego-competitive, you have to, like, be aggressive, you have to do your thing, particularly with males, but I think in general with everybody. And Buddhism doesn't want to interfere with the religious aspect in the West. It's not trying to convert people to Buddhism. But it has a psychology, a kind of mind science, that is usable within whatever religious framework. And so I kind of, you know, Jesus himself, because of the social circumstances in his culture, was only able to teach for 4 years. And the Buddha, poor guy, he had to slave away for 46 years after his enlightenment. And so he had time to provide more practical methodologies to underlie these sort of high moral sounding slogans like love your enemy. And so, just like what Sharon just said, it's more, you know, some people can make a choice that they would rather not carry around the burden of hatred. I was listening to Martin Luther King recently in a show, a program on somewhere, and John Lewis was quoting him as saying that the burden of hatred is just too much to bear. It's just unbearable, and we're not going to deal with it. And we're even though they're sitting dogs on us, they're hitting fire hoses, they're beating us, arresting us, lynching us, we're not going to hate them. And because that's not the way, and even that's paralyzing to us, and it cripples us, actually.
Yeah.
And there can be such a thing. Now, the other thing, of course, that we haven't mentioned yet, but both Sharon and I are completely agree with, there is such a thing as tough love, or in Tibetan, the Tibetans would like prefer maybe the expression fierce compassion. And this is like where you don't indulge another person in their evil doing or their nasty behavior, and sometimes you have to be forceful. But that forcefulness with them will have a different impact and will be subliminally sensed by them as coming from a different place when it doesn't have that extra bite, that extra sting of hatred and vindictiveness in it. It's just forceful opposition to whatever negative things they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so the psychology of love your enemies does not just mean come and trample us, come kill me, my enemy, oh,
right,
yes, I want you to shoot me or something. It means, you know, I want you to be happy. I'm going to be happy no matter what. And it's better. You'll be more happy if you don't kill me, actually. And I might be more happier if you don't kill me, but I'm going to be happy whatever you do to me. But on that basis, I might take your weapon away. I might be a kung fu master. Mm. I might whatever. I might shoot you. Actually, if you're about to shoot 150 other people, I might be forced. I try not to kill you, but I might be forced to do something forceful. There is the concept, in other words, of surgical violence sometimes, you know. Mm-hmm. And we deal with that in the book, you know. We do.
You know, I wonder, as the two of you, this is the hardest kind of question, as the two of you live with these teachings, I think sometimes as exacting as that kind of life drama is, there's also, it may be hardest of all to put these kinds of things into practice, you know, say in your most intimate relationships, right? Do you find that as you work with these teachings, and I know you both have long time meditation practices, that do you become more able to modulate your responses like that?
Well,
there
now,
you go.
One thing I didn't say about when Sharon and I. All right, this gives me a chance to go backtrack a little and talk about when Sharon and I got together. You know what? Why I love working with Sharon, and why I still love working with Sharon. I was a little in my Buddhist studies had a different path, and in the Tibetan tradition, traditionally, they do not encourage people to meditate right away. Actually, they think that if you meditate right away before you have learned something, and before you have unlearned a number of distorted things. Mm. That your meditation could take you in the wrong direction because you're operating under some sort of distorted concepts. So they press you to learn things. And my original teacher, this wonderful old Mongolian gentleman named Geshe Wangyal, who was a Mongolian who had been in Tibet for 35 years and was a good friend of the Dalai Lama and his relatives, he kept interrupting me when I would try to meditate, when I was first studying. And I would get on the Four Noble Truths, and I'd be going, and Nirvana, I'd be going for whatever my concept of Nirvana was, the out of body, actually. And I was having some kind of really good, you know, altered states. And the guy had, like, radar, and he would show up, and he would interrupt me 3 a.m. He'd come and, like, knock on the door of my room and say, you're not sleeping. Why are you wasting your time? What are you doing? Meditating? That's a waste of time. Come have some yogurt in the kitchen, this kind of thing. He would tend to do that. So then I became a scholar, of course, and a professor, and et cetera. And so I was more on the conceptual side of Buddhism, you know, the philosophical and spiritual side, than the meditative side. But after a while, I was beginning to really miss the meditating. So I really envied Sharon and Jack and Joseph and those guys they were professionally meditating. They could meditate all the time. And I think Sharon is more calm than I am and more stabilized and more enlightened. And so I like being around her. It makes me more calm and more stabilized, more in the moment. Although meditation is so much in demand in our society now that they're all becoming these terribly busy meditators. And they're doing a lot of their work on planes and trains.
It's competitive meditation. And,
that's right. But anyway, they are like that. So that was what I just wanted to bring up. So then in my own case about the anger thing, it was always a big problem for me in my life. And I think maybe it was my actual nature or maybe it was my lineage, a bunch of military generals. Mm. I have a lot of generals in my family, rednecks, you know. And also maybe my older brother used to pound on me a little too much, which I defended myself with hot temper. Mm. So whatever all the different causes were, I tended to have an explosive temper. So definitely Buddhism has helped me, but I don't claim to be enlightened, so I'm not saying that I'm totally 100% cured. But like the Dalai Lama likes to say, he also loses his temper, he says. And he likes to say that, well, nowadays it only lasts for a second and he doesn't hold the bitterness about it. And sometimes, very often, it doesn't last. I don't think he really does get really mad, actually. But nowadays, he did a bit more. He was more nervous when he was younger. So I think I still have a harder time with it. But I'm still working on it, and I like being with Sharon because she encourages me to be more mindful and try to interrupt the mechanism of the anger explosion. You know, the tough, which then I have the danger of rationalizing and saying, oh, it's tough love or fierce compassion. Actually, I'm just mad. So Sharon helps me with that. My wife, of course, is my main guru on that. And but Sharon also
because
is
she's
a big
there.
Help, so.
She's there. Well, and okay. So this all in a roundabout way brings us to this notion of inner enemies, and I love that that correlation you draw between this teaching of Jesus of love of enemies, which is such a beautiful image and so compelling, but really what it needs is exacting inner work. And that's that teaching about how to do that exacting inner work and sustain it and grow it, you're right, is not necessarily there at the same time that beautiful phrase is there. So talking about dealing with outer enemies ultimately always leads back to inner work, doesn't it? I mean,
mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there's that tremendous irony and poignancy of life that we can't look, even if we do see somebody's wrong actions and malevolent speech or whatever as coming from a place of suffering, which we, you know, we do believe it is. And even if we see that,
yeah,
even if we perceive that, the great poignancy of life is that you can't look at somebody else and say, poof, your suffering's gone, you know, you're a better person now. You know, we don't have that kind of control. We don't have that kind of dominance. And I usually say when I'm teaching, you know, I think it would likely be a better world if I did, if any one of us did, but we don't. And so we understand that, and we do what we can, obviously, to change conditions and be helpful, be restorative, you know, work to try to make things different. But it's not going to be in our hands, ultimately, what we can mold much more successfully, although that is also not a case of, poof, now I'm better.
Yeah.
But we can work with ourselves, with our own minds and hearts, and become really actually transformed in a real way.
So just how do you start at the most basic level of talking about where that work begins?
Well, for me, it would begin with mindfulness. It would begin with what we were talking about earlier, just a sense of looking, because we actually don't know. We know what we've been taught, that maybe vengefulness is good, that love is weak. Whatever it might be, the assumptions we carry, the concepts, and we need to take a direct look at the entire range of our emotional landscape to know for ourselves, you know, is vulnerability always wrong? Is that kind of defensiveness always right? What is the strength of anger? It does have energy, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
It's a great attribute, but look at that brittleness. Look at that sense of tunnel vision. You know, if you think about the last time you were really, really, really angry at yourself, it's probably not also a time where you think, you know, I did that great thing that very same morning. I said that really stupid thing. It's like, that's gone. You know, our whole sense of who we are and all that we will ever be just collapses around that stupid thing we said. And so we look at the whole nature, the flavor, the texture of all of these states, and we then use the mindfulness to really work with letting go with what we feel is bringing us down and making our life smaller and more filled with suffering and enhancing and enriching those qualities that really bring us to the reality, which is that we're all connected and that we need to care about one another and ourselves.
You know,
that's marvelous. Marvelous.
I think physically as well as emotionally, we instinctively, I can certainly speak for myself in this, you know, recoil from the reality of feeling vulnerable or afraid, right? So we layer, I mean, anger gets layered on top of that because it feels like a more powerful response. And, but then we stop being able to tell the difference ourselves, right? You stop knowing, I'm scared, you say, I'm angry. You know, Sharon, I know one thing that you've said in different ways at different times, and I just found this. These were words, I think, from another interview you gave as I was getting ready to talk to you again. It's one of life's big mysteries to me, you said, that we don't talk to each other about the most common things, like the fact that we wake up in the morning feeling confused and scared and full of self-doubt. The miracle is when someone finally names it, that's so liberating. And, I mean, really what you're talking about is being honest, and it's the most frightening thing to admit that you're afraid, but what a relief, what a relief when we can do that.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's like me as a 15-year-old or 16-year-old, or I guess I was maybe 16 or 17 at that point in college at that Asian philosophy course, you know, to hear that the Buddha said right out loud, there's suffering in life. Guess what? It's not just you. It's not something to be ashamed of. It's not something to hide or you know, sort of seek others who are suffering to be hidden from you. It's not mm-hmm. it's not like that. This is part of the nature of things. And if we could just be open and truthful, as you say, and admit that, then we would find one another in that vulnerability instead of feeling so cut off and so apart.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Bob, what are you thinking?
What am I thinking?
Yeah, as you're listening to that. Do you want to add anything?
That, what I was thinking was that, you know, there's a word in Buddhism called klesha, or kilesa in Pali, klesha in Sanskrit, which comes from a verb root that means to twist, to something to be twisted. And it's translated defilement or affliction by some people. I used to translate affliction. But the best word for it actually is addiction. Mm. And so anger and obsession, lust, these things are said to be addictions. And that immediately gets the point across. In other words, it's something that people think is helping them because it gives them a momentary relief from something else. Mm. But actually, it's leading them into a worse and worse place where they're getting more and more dependent and less free. And so...
Dependent because that because your the way you're handling it is then all entangled with the
partly,
other person.
Yes, partly because you believe when anger comes to you out, meaning in the form of an impulse that you have internally, mm-hmm. this is intolerable. That person did this. This is like something, you know. It's what sort of the inner thought that comes. And it seems to come in a way that is undeniable. You have to act on it. Mm-hmm. It mobilizes right. your adrenaline, your solar plexus, your arms, your body. Heat flushes up into your face. It sort of goes along with a whole complex of things, and you just charge ahead or say something awful or whatever you do. Or you put away in your mind some nasty scheme that you're going to implement later mm-hmm. if for some reason you can't do it right away. So, in other words, it takes you over. And that's where mindfulness can interfere with that by being aware of how your mind works and realizing that it's just one impulse and it's one voice within you. And there's another questioning voice and an awareness voice that can say, well, actually, would this be a good idea to blow your top now? Or, you know, it's like I always like to say it's like otherwise you're like a TV set that has one channel only and no clicker. So if you have
I don't
the,
remember
if
what that's the, like.
If you have the horror, if you have the horror show rising up yeah. from your solar plexus, then you got to have a horror show. Whereas you can click mm-hmm. to the nature show, you know, you can watch the minnows frolicking in the lake, you know, in the summer. So I'm saying, you know, that we are very clickable, we're very switchable in our moods and minds. And if we so the very key first point is to recognize that whenever we lose our awareness by any kind of impulse, what the Buddhists call the three poisons or the five poisons, they have different words for these kleshas. They even have a list of 100 of them, mm-hmm. the minor ones. And then that is distorting, it's twisting our existence. And so it's like any addict, alcohol, drugs, particular drugs, it's like that is not my friend. That's something I'm going to work on against. So there's that turning point where we decide, well, that really doesn't help me. And then the key is the hopeful thing for some people who like their anger. Some people do like their anger. Hmm. The hopeful thing is that energy of heat, kind of like a heat, you know, in Buddhist psychology, anger is connected to intelligence, to analytic and critical intelligence, which sort of takes things apart and looks at their causes. Because it's sort of disintegrative. It disintegrates what's in front of it by analyzing it, which is an interesting connection. And so that energy of strong, powerful energy of heat, force, can be taken away from the conceptual structure of anger at an object and can be ridden in a different way and can be used to heal yourself, can be used to develop inner strength and determination. And that is really something much to be ambitious for. That is a great, great goal. Mm. And people like Sharon, who have become more calm and cool and happy over life, no, they are living demonstrations that this does help.
Really?
Well, shucks. Thank you.
I think also that kind of transmutation is connected to this particular Buddhist notion of metta, loving kindness, which holds not just some kind of compassion towards others, which can be hard to muster, but compassion towards oneself, which makes compassion
can be harder.
Can be harder. but makes all kinds of things possible.
You know, one should not confuse compassion for oneself with self-indulgence.
Right.
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 That's a difficult.
Right.
Yeah. That's, I mean, metta, that struck me so strongly when I first began practicing metta or loving kindness. I was in Burma in 1985 when I first practiced it intensively in a structured way. And I always knew how it was done. I always knew that classically you began with yourself, which I found kind of confusing because I thought, well, surely the higher path, the more spiritual way would be denying yourself and, some kind of self-abnegation and then, just focusing completely on others. And that would be the way. But going back to what is realistic or not, they also say that metta or loving kindness is a practice of generosity. It's like generosity of the spirit. And the best kind of generosity comes from a sense of inner abundance. Mm. Because if we feel depleted and overcome and exhausted and just burnt out, we're not going to have the wherewithal inside, the sense of resourcefulness to care about anybody, even to notice them all that much. It's not only a kind of self-indulgence, but it's a self-preoccupation that happens when we feel so undone, so unworthy, so incapable of giving or whatever it might be, however it might manifest. And so I really do see that factor of loving kindness for oneself is this tremendous sense of strength and resourcefulness in terms of connecting to others.
And of softness with oneself, making that possible, which, I don't know, even when we're trying to be altruistic or generous, we're hard on ourselves, right? We push ourselves, and this is a different attitude.
Oh, it's very different. I mean, I guess the one question that's very interesting to reflect on is how do I actually learn best? How do I change? How do I grow? Is it through that kind of belittling myself and berating myself and humiliating myself? Or is it through something else, some other quality like self-compassion and recognizing the pain or unskillfulness of something I've done or said and having the energy to actually move on? So where does that energy come from? It comes from not being stuck. And how do we get unstuck? In effect, it's from forgiving ourselves and realizing, it happened, it was wrong. I'm going to go on now in a different way because I'm capable of that. I am capable of change.
The two of you, in your discussions about enemies, you also, so there's the outer enemies, they're the inner enemies, which, while challenging to combat, are it's pretty clear what you're talking about. And then there's this notion of the secret enemy and the super secret enemy, and I mean it's interesting language to begin with, but I really want to understand what you mean, and also what's the difference between the secret enemy and the super secret enemy. So what are we talking about here?
I wish I knew. I have to reread the books. I'm just kidding. There are these two mental habits that lie at the core of the unenlightened psychology in the Buddhist view. And one of them is called this, basically it translates literally as the self habit or self-grasping. And it's a kind of cognitive thing rather than a moral thing. It's different from selfishness. It's where one thinks of oneself as a fixed, rigid identity separate from everything else, that somehow is constituted of itself. You know, it's like, when you see a picture of yourself in a scene like 5 years ago at a picnic, at a party, or, whatever, traveling in some setting, and you then remember the scene you were in, we all have the idea that I was just exactly the same subjectivity then as I am now. And so this seems to be this unchanging point of identity in us, which we cling to. And this is the root of our problems in Buddha's breakthrough insight as a psychologist, not a religious thing.
Right.
It's his psychological breakthrough because, of course, there is no such thing. Every cell in your body has changed. Your mind has had all kinds of other experiences, and, you know, you're completely, and even at the time, you were very involved in whatever your environment was, we all were. And there is continuity, of course, because we can remember the situation, but we're really very, very different. And so the idea that the habitual idea that there's this unchanged thing is actually a tremendous cause of suffering because, in fact, we're changing all the time. So it's the ultimately most inwardly unrealistic thing that you can think of. Talk about realism. And it's sort of a, it comes from a sense of sort of the fear and also even a sense of the inconvenience of being completely interconnected with everything all the time. You know, that somehow you want to have a kind of, we're wrongly thinking that freedom means to be disconnected from other things, to withdraw from connection. And so we sort of try to withdraw into this place of the separate, and the Buddhists have many wonderful terms, intrinsic identity, intrinsic reality, intrinsic objectivity of ourself, the intrinsic ego, you could say, not necessarily the resilient interactive ego, but the intrinsic ego. So that's the secret enemy, actually.
And it's secret,
the reason it's secret is that it's invisible to us. Mm-hmm. That's what we're sort of assigning to the role.
It's so imprinted in us internally. It's so imprinted in us internally that we're not even aware of it.
Right, and it's invisible to us because we think it was what we are. Mm-hmm. But it's what makes us unable to control ourselves in a way because, for example, take anger, coming back to anger. When we're angry, we think it's that unchanging thing that is anger. So therefore, the anger has a kind of quality of absoluteness. I just have to do this. And that's why people will kill, actually, when they're filled with enough hatred and anger. Absolute in the sense of much more important than other person's life, or some people will kill themselves even when they get into that state where the emotion, you know, seems to connect to this absolute disconnected self that never was there, but we habitually think it's there, and thereby is more absolute than our own living, breathing life. Mm. And people get so depressed they'll kill themselves. And they get so angry and hateful in an interactive situation, they'll kill others. Or hurt themselves. You know, people will bang their head on walls and things like that, you know, and hurt their head, you know. So that's the secret enemy. Anyway, that's what we're assigning to the role of secret enemy. And then the super secret enemy, more underlying that, is a kind of what they call self-cherishing or self-preoccupation. Sharon mentioned it already. Self-preoccupation, self-cherishing, selfishness.
Like narcissism.
It's something like narcissism, mm-hmm. Yeah, where one is kind of, you know, inwardly always just looking at everything from one's own perspective, mm-hmm. unaware of the reality of others, in a way looking out for number one, but at a almost subliminal level, which is why it's super secret. And the reason I'm joking about whether what's secret and what's super secret, and I wish I knew, is in some of the more traditional psychological texts, they make the self-habit the most foundational one and the self-preoccupation the first derivative of that. Mm. And then in some, they make the selfish one the deepest one. And to me, that's challenging. And so that's why I kind of lobbied for that to be the super secret.
Right.
But, you know, who knows? You know? I don't pretend to really have when I get to be a Buddha someday, I'll know for sure which is secret and which is super secret.
Will you tell us?
I will. Sure. I promise.
Well, so
I promise
I
will.
I'm not sure if this may be really off base, but in terms of the self-habit, the secret, the identity instinct is another way you said it. And what it made me think of, and I don't know if this is an example of this or maybe an analogy, is this terrible reality that I think I know this in myself a lot. I know this in so many people. You leave home, you go away, you have this life, you become an adult, and then but into old age, you know, I go home to, and my mother and father are there, and I am suddenly a 14-year-old again. It's like there's this immature awkward, difficult, emotional person. And it almost, you know, it feels like that's some core reality. Other people tell their versions of this story. Is that an analogy of what you're talking about psychologically?
Yeah, maybe. But the other analogy there, or the other element there, is that your parents themselves, and I'm a bit older, I'm sure, than you, and I'm much older than Sharon, and the difficulty people have with being old is even at old age, they still feel they're young.
Yes.
But the body doesn't obey. They look at themselves in the mirror and they freak. and they feel they should have that 16-year-old identity in there because they feel it's there. But yet nothing seems to, the circumstances don't support that. And so then they feel very much unhappy because, like, why, you know, and then they have that kind of expression, youth is wasted on the young. You know,
yeah, right, kind of right. Mm-hmm.
So everyone is crippled in every respect by the unrealism of thinking that they are something apart from others, ultimately and absolutely separate from them, and fixed and unchanging in the middle of all of this change. And so every educational method that the Buddhist tradition devised, meditation, conceptual learning, critical reflection, is all designed to help us discover that we are just a totally interrelated being. Relativity was Buddha's great discovery in emotional, psychological, as well as physicist sense. Mm. And we're all totally interrelated, and that's blissful. When we realize that we might think if we surrender to being totally connected to everything, how awful, then we'll have everybody else's headache, we'll be stuck everything in everybody else's mess. But actually the weird thing is, which is hard to imagine and hard to explain, maybe unexplainable ultimately, but it actually, they insist, it's blissful. Mm-hmm. And of course bliss is, we haven't really addressed the happiness issue, but bliss and happiness of course are the key to all of this ultimately. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think part of the, you know, what accompanies that sense of separateness is this effort to be in control.
Mm-hmm.
And right, this right, belief that we can be in control. And that, of course, is an exercise in futility and leads to such incredible disappointment and loneliness as mm-hmm. we try to seize control over everything, the aging process mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. relationships and work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not that we're helpless and that there's nothing we can do, but we have to honor the truth of causes and conditions. You know, we do mm-hmm. everything we can, hopefully, to try to make a better world, for example. But this idea that we are going to be finally, ultimately in control, so it's going to happen on our timetable, mm-hmm. is really pretty disappointing. And so there are a lot of consequences to recognizing the interconnection as well, that we realize we're part of a whole, each one of us. And it's not, you know, kind of wildly mystical or fanciful. In fact, my favorite exercise in any gathering that I do is to first urge people, okay, why don't you just see who comes to mind when you try to think who has any kind of relationship to your being here in this room right now? You know, who gave you a book or told you about their meditation practice or told you about this place or whatever it is? And we see that, you know what, we're each here as part of relationship, conversation, connection, and that this moment, like every moment in time, is a confluence mm-hmm. of all these things coming together. And however alone and apart we might feel, that's actually not what's real. Mm-hmm. What's real is this vast, vast web of connection.
Wonderful. One of the disciplines, the spiritual disciplines that you describe towards, you know, towards living in this healthier way with the reality of our lives and of enemies in them, inside and without, is this notion, this discipline of looking for the good in others. and I mean, which really, in our culture, we're trained to, at a really basic level, to see what has gone wrong today as the news, right? That's what mm-hmm. that's what we look at. That's what our eyes and our attention is trained to see. This notion of looking for the good in others, even and especially people who we may identify as enemies, and one of the principles of that's you know so liberating to think about is that just as we are all changing every day, both on a cellular level and psychological level as we move through life, so are the people who it's difficult for us to share the planet with, and sort of kind of acknowledge, right? Acknowledging that possibility in others as well.
Well, it's really true. I first was given that as a meditation instruction when I went to Burma in 1985, and I was doing that period of intensive loving kindness practice. And one of the first suggestions my meditation teacher, Saida Upandita, gave to me was, think of different people you have different feelings for, different kind of relationships with, and see if you can find one good thing about them. And my very first thought was, I'm not going to do that. I thought, that's what stupid people do. They go around looking for the good in people. I don't even like people who do that. I'm not going to do that. But as I usually tell the story, I was very far from home. I was in a Burmese monastery. And the nature of the teacher-student relationship in a very traditional culture like that is not one where the teacher suggests you do something and you say, I don't feel like it. It's like, you do it. So I did it, and it was so interesting because, you know, of course my fear had been that I was going to be really stupid and I was going to overlook the things that were really wrong and I was going to become conflict avoidant. And it wasn't at all like that. I realized that if I just obsessed about everything that was wrong one more time, it wasn't onward leading in any way. But if I could find one good thing about somebody, I actually felt a sense of connection to them or kinship with them so that I could directly and honestly look at what was difficult. But it was almost like from a different place. It was almost as though we were standing side by side instead of across this huge gulf of separation. And I even thought of somebody I really found incredibly obnoxious, I think in a very reasonable way. I think he was pretty obnoxious, not just to me.
Right.
But I had this memory that came up in my mind of once having seen him do this incredibly gracious, kind thing for somebody else that we both know. And he did this act in the best possible way, so she didn't feel condescended to or put down or pitied in any way. He just did it so beautifully. So this memory came up in my mind, and then I thought, I don't want to think about that. It complicates things. It was easier when he was like all bad all the time.
Right, you know? Right.
But life is complicated. Relationships are complicated. We're complicated too.
Yeah. Would you also talk about the give and take meditation that the two of you describe is also a way to work with this.
Sure.
Yeah.
Give and take is a visualization meditation that is usually connected with people who are working at the super secret enemy level. That is to say, they're working on their self preoccupation, and they're practicing the method known as the equal exchange of self and other. Which means, doesn't really mean, of course, you can't occupy another person's being, but what you can try to do, and it's not, again, a particularly religious thing or a Buddhist thing, you put yourself in the other person's perspective or put yourself in the other fellow's shoes, right? We have like a proverb like that. And so it's a practice like that where you look at yourself from another person's point of view. And when you're working on that, then sometimes in a meditation you'll decide to practice give and take. And what that involves is connected with your breathing, where, you know, you're in whatever setting you have created around your meditation space, whatever framework or environment you have established for it. And they're very conscious, usually, in the Tibetan tradition of what that environment is and what you think you are and all that. But I won't get into that. But anyway, so there, as you exhale, you think that your own happiness coming from your sense of reality, that reality itself is an inexhaustible well of positive energy, which is the Mahayana Buddhist view, that the deepest layer of reality is not a blank space that's nothingness like a materialist would think, where there's nothing there. There is no nothing there or here or anywhere, because nothing isn't there. It's not a place. And the deepest place is what they call the clear light of the void, or the clear light of emptiness, which is a kind of translucent plenum of energy, which is infinite and can be drawn on inexhaustibly although it's hard to detect because in itself it doesn't do anything. It doesn't need to because it's infinite. So there's nothing left undone, you could say, something like that. So you emanate from your deepest open center, which is connected to that infinite energy, positive energy, that is the ground of the universe in the Buddhist view, and you send light out with your exhalation as you exhale toward other beings. And you could pick a particular being, or you could think of yourself surrounded by all beings. And this light is a light of abundance, of energy, and when it seeks the particular being, it provides them with what it is that they need on a psychic or physical, turn itself into medicine, turn itself into energy, turn itself into calmness, whatever it may be, but it goes out in the form of light toward them. And then you imagine their own inner feeling of suffering or inadequacy or insufficiency or deprivation or frustration, whatever you think of them as feeling. And again, it can be a single individual or many. And as you inhale, you draw that away from them in the form of a cloudy, smoky, darkness kind of shadowy thing that's afflicting them. Kind of they're in the shadow. And so as you inhale this darkness of unhappiness from them. And when it goes into your nostrils with your breath, it goes down to your heart center where your heart is connected to this vast, infinite, inconceivable energy. So then it's completely dissipates there. It doesn't burden you in a certain way. It goes to your core. And then again, you exhale light to them from your happiness, and you absorb their suffering and dissipate it in the energy, infinite energy of all enlightened beings, of all inanimate. It's like a physical reality, actually. This infinite, it's something like the quantum zero point field that the physicists talk about, quantum people do talk about. Mm-hmm. It's where there's infinite energy of the vacuum. You know, it's kind of an inconceivability, so never mind. But it's kind of a thing you get a glimpse of, actually, when you meditate a lot. Huh. And so that's what it is. It's like exchanging, giving away your bliss, your happiness, and absorbing other suffering. But it has to be within this wisdom context of where your deepest level of existence, the energy of your cells, your health, etc., is this clear light of the void. So you're reinforced by all enlightened beings to be able to do that. If someone tried to do that where they were just thinking of, like in a martyr sense, I'm going to just take all this suffering on me and what I am is this fixed identity separate from everything, then once fixed identity separate, then it would become a greater and greater sphere of darkness.
Right.
So it would be hard to do that, and it would not necessarily be even good for a person. So you have to, it's like, now coming back to an earlier thing we were saying, just let me just connect that. The thing about being compassionate and loving to yourself comes from, is the way in which you begin to realize what your real happiness is. And your own real happiness is when you feel at peace with contentment with wherever you are. You have a sort of sense that there is this positive energy within you and around you, rather than that there's nothing and you're poised above an abyss of nothing,
right,
or that you're just a meaningless piece of whatever. You're like materialists say, we're like a, you know, 15 cents worth of cheap chemicals in a bag of water.
Right.
You know, like what that's what the materialists say. Or maybe some of them say 85 cents. Maybe the minerals have increased in value. I don't know. But my point is, you that's where the love of yourself comes, where you stop being so dependent on outer goods and outer achievements and outer circumstances, and you begin to feel kind of welling up within yourself a goodness about yourself that is a happiness within you. And that's where you want yourself to be able to experience that, to be open to that. And then once you have that happiness, then you can do give and take.
Right.
But try to do it when you're miserable will maybe only add to your misery. So again, this is why these meditations require a wisdom component always, along with a positive emotion. And that awareness is wisdom always. Mindfulness is a form of wisdom, the beginning form of wisdom.
Hmm. Right. And that openness also allows you to somehow be more open in a way that is good for you and for the world, open to the suffering of others.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, I think it's so interesting that, you know, there's such a interest these days in empathy and mm-hmm. Rightly so.
Even in science, even scientifically.
Even in science,
yeah.
You know,
yes.
And it's a wonderful thing, but there's one way of seeing it so that empathy is a necessary but not sufficient condition for mm-hmm. compassion, that they're really not identical, that mm-hmm. we might genuinely open to the suffering of others, which we need to do, but then be frightened by that.
Right, or not know what to do with it, not be able to.
That's right. We feel helpless, we feel overcome, or we feel blaming. You know, like, mm-hmm. I gave you really good advice last year. Why didn't you take it? You wouldn't be suffering so much. or we might get into that weird sort of effort, you know, like, I'm going to fix it by tonight or maybe Tuesday at the latest. And, you know, or we might have the compassionate response, which is its own kind of response to seeing suffering, which has its sense of sufficiency, not really being overcome, you know, brutalized and just destroyed by the suffering, because then we have nothing left to give. You know, then our own pain actually becomes the central focus of what's going on in that moment.
Right. And I think that image that Bob just used of the suffering, in that meditation, the suffering comes through you, but mm-hmm. it doesn't harm you. You are able to hold it because you're able to understand yourself to be held in something much larger.
Hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
It's because you have such a strong will of contentment and inner bliss. That's very, very key.
Mm-hmm.
That is the actual root of love, of course, because love wishes the happiness of the other, right? So when you love another, that is. And so if you have no idea what happiness is, because you're so into conceiving yourself as miserable, then how are you going to love someone else, you know?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think this all also gets at something else that really intrigues me in the way the two of you talk about our whole life with enemies and with suffering, and that is this very intriguing idea of healing our relationship with time, befriending mm-hmm. time, and in that way also tapping into a spaciousness and a perspective. Could you talk a little bit more about that and how to, I mean, it's such a wonderful idea. You know, what do you offer in terms of teaching, in terms of helping people draw close to that idea as a reality?
Well, I missed what...
The question was about healing our relationship with time.
Oh, right. Oh. Mm-hmm.
And then, which is really fascinating because... it's like the tyranny of time, you know. I don't have enough time.
And right.
There's never enough time. And whatever happened to my life, you know, it's passed by like a dream.
It goes faster and faster.
That
believe
time?
Me, as you reach this eighth decade. Trust me.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not that much younger, really. That was nice of you to say, but...
But this notion of the infinite in each moment, and somehow, which is not it's not something we learn anywhere in our lives now. And so, how to apprehend that knowledge? Uh-huh. How to really claim?
Well,
that
I think
knowledge.
That you know, there's so much power we potentially have when we realize how our interpretation and our assumptions and our perception affects our experience, and that. We don't have to be mired in old ways of seeing, that we don't have to feel stuck, even if we start out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what happens through the meditative process, is that you realize you have a kind of flexibility around things. And it's not, you know, again, to be sort of in the realm of wishful thinking or being a goody-goody, but to realize I don't need to be stuck. You know, if I'm in the habit of seeing at the end of the day, looking back at the day and pretty well only remembering what went wrong, I can actually move my attention mm-hmm. very consciously and intentionally to what went right, not to pretend that was the only thing that happened, but to kind of fill in the picture, you know, to be more inclusive. And we can do that with time as well. I tell this story sometimes about going to see one of my teachers, this Tibetan teacher, Nyoshul Ken Rinpoche, in Taiwan. I loved him very, very much. We were very close. He was a very important teacher for me, and he was always kind of ill or sickly. And I'd gone with some friends to see him in Taiwan, and he didn't seem that well at the time. And but he was kind of centrally located, which was very important in Taiwan. And then he moved to some other remote place. And we were going to see him again. And I was standing there with my friends in front of the hotel waiting for the cars to come pick us up. And we're all holding flowers and fruit and all these things we're going to offer. And I was so sad. And I kept thinking, this may be the last time I ever see him. I may only see him one more time in this lifetime. That is so desolating feeling, and that's so awful. And then we got into these separate cabs and went off, and the cabs got completely lost. And we're just like wandering around the roads and somewhere near Taiwan. And it was just awful. And I watched my mind flip to, I would give anything to see him one more time. Like one more time suddenly seemed like the best thing in the world.
Right, right.
If I could only
have
that.
Shift in perspective, right.
That's right.
That's funny.
And we have the ability to do that. That's part of what we actually cultivate. And, you know, people are a little bit squeamish about it sometimes. Like, oh, that's going to be, you know, weird and pretentious and phony, and I'm going to put a gloss on everything, and I'm not going to experience loss, honestly, and change and all those things, because I'm just trying to, you know, be upbeat about the present moment. But it's really not that way. It's understanding we just have the limitation of so much conditioning, which isn't permanent. It's just a construct, and that we can, it's almost like an exercise. We're going to exercise now looking at things from this angle rather than that angle. And we realize, oh, this is also true. It's not phony, but it doesn't get a lot of airtime usually.
Yeah.
Let me look at it from this place.
Mm-hmm. I very much admire the contemporary teacher Eckhart Tolle and how his concept of the power of now and all of that, and how he gets away from time by helps people do that, always leads them back to the present moment and unfolding the richness of the present moment. And I find that very effective, and it fits with things that Buddhist psychology does. Also, mindfulness will very much bring you into the present moment as well. Although then there's a thing that I've talked to Eckhart, and I think it's very important, and maybe I believe he addresses, of course, in his books. And I think maybe we'll focus more on that in the books that is forthcoming. I'm not giving away any secrets here. He indicated to me he might. And that is that in our materialist culture, we have this idea that the essence of everything is nothingness. Because when we die, we're going to be nothing. When we fall asleep, we go to nothing. And so if you go absolutely into removing all of the your sense of worry about the future and being stuck in reminiscing about the past, come into the present moment, you've sort of come into a null place,
right,
which is out of the flow of time. So you've escaped from it temporarily or something like that. And that is a little bit of a trap, I feel. It's like a palliative, maybe for someone who's overly bitter about the past,
right,
or overly anxious about the future, so it gives them a buzz. And so they get into it. But in a way, it then a little bit makes them unable to address issues that involve gradual and progressive change and development. So I do think that the underlying, to be critical to that underlying concept and to realize that there's no moment, there is no present moment without its relationship to past and future, actually. So when you're narrowing down into, like, I'm not going to think about past and future, you're coming into a place where the whole past and future are present, really, rather than some sort of isolated nothing that's outside of the flow of time. And so when you get into a moment like that, it's like what you said, Krista, where it is the moment is infinite. So then not only do you enjoy the richness of that moment, but if in that moment you can make something a tiny bit better, I mean, the color could be, instead of this drab beige, it could be a more like rich beige with a little more yellow tone in it. Whatever tiny thing it is, you're growing it for the infinite future and that little infinite positive change. If you're a little depressed or something, you're sad about something in the past, then you do a little tiny change. You can live within that moment and it can so that that moment is connected to the infinite future. Mm-hmm. Then that's a much richer moment. It's sort of it relates to what we call in Buddhist philosophy and psychology non-dualist or non-duality, where each moment is, of course, contains all, like a hologram. Each moment contains all the other moments infinitely. But also each future moment contains this moment and all the past moments. And therefore, the richness also connects to goodwill, to love and compassion. It isn't just an escape into a kind of null state, you know.
Mm.
And Buddhism can be badly misunderstood because of its focus on the concept of voidness or emptiness, that it's sort of going along with this null state idea that the materialists give us in our so-called secular scientific dogmas of it's only matter, you know. And so that's something to think about, I see.
That's wonderful.
Time. There is a positive sense of time. For example, Buddha had a vow as a bodhisattva. He would not achieve nirvana or perfect blissfulness until all beings had achieved it. Then he achieved nirvana 2,500 years ago. And what about us? Well, what did he do with us? Do you know what I mean? There is a problem like that. So technically speaking, we in order to not accuse Buddha of abandoning us in this flow of time filled with suffering, we have to somehow imagine that it's possible that in that moment he found our future liberation moment.
Right,
it was available to him.
Right.
And the time between his moment of seeing that and our moment of seeing that, whether it's thousands of years in the future, in the lifetime, maybe I was a bug sitting somewhere under his mat that time, whatever it was, that moment is in a way a wonderful, rich time of evolution for me to become, leave my bughood and get to be a Buddha myself someday far in the future. So there's that kind of idea, you know? And that's in the Buddhist story. That's there in the Buddhist story, how he saw everybody else's future life and past life in the moment just as he was attaining enlightenment. It says so in all the versions of his story.
It makes me think really of Einstein saying that our physical perception of time is a linear thing of past, present, and future, and some kind of, as an arrow, is a stubbornly persistent illusion. Right.
Exactly.
But our five senses conspire in that illusion.
Of course.
You know, we just have a few more minutes, and what I'd like to do just briefly is really touch on what I want to say the public life implications of this thinking, this teaching, about how we, especially, you know, again, more specifically about how we interact with enemies, you know. And I don't want to talk about so much about, you know, warring states or enemies out there, but I think the vocabulary of enemies in American culture has become very vivid, the vocabulary and the experience in recent years. And, you know, just kind of wondering what wisdom, you know, how you watch that, the two of you, and what wisdom you might have to offer up, how you think that through.
I think on one level, you know, it's not easy, and it's also tremendously healing and inspiring for others to be able to see somebody as an opponent rather than an enemy, and to realize that you might marshal a lot of energy to try to defeat them or protect somebody else or make for some kind of change in society, but without hatred. And we do have some models, you know, not perhaps as many as we would like or need, but, you know, we do have people like the Dalai Lama, for example, or Aung San Suu Kyi or Bishop Tutu or, you know,
they're so heroic, though.
I know,
so
they're like over the top.
All right.
Well, we have mothers, you know. Who are dealing with lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have extraordinary people living so-called ordinary lives who are every day managing to have a long-term perspective, for example, and not feel defeated by circumstance. We have teachers who are going into those classrooms every day and realizing, okay, I may not see the fruit of my efforts today or this week or even this year, but I've got to be present for these children in a way that is maybe mm-hmm. different from anything else they have in their lives. And I can't call them an enemy. I can't abandon them or forsake them. I mean, there's so many levels to that. You know, I think certainly, you know, look, as you say, look at the way we use language now. It's war on everything.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
But, you know, one of the things I've really gotten that it's one of those very simple teachings from Buddhist psychology that is yet very profound and has been very effective for me is look for causes and conditions. Don't just stay on the surface of things. If you're trying to make for change, if you're, you know, trying to undo something, you've got to look at causes and conditions to the best of your ability and see what is underlying it. I remember this Thai activist, Sulak Shiva Rakshra, saying when he was visiting us in Barrie once, he said, if you want to really undermine or even destroy the sex trade in Thailand, you've got to look at agricultural policy. You know, look at why those farmers are selling their children. Look deeper. And, you know, then the change we make might be not only coming from a different place, but be more effective.
Mm. Yes. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, after 9/11, he wrote to President Bush Jr. that, you know, he violence would not help. He was very sorry for the terrible thing that had happened, et cetera, et cetera. But a violent response would be counterproductive. He wrote that. And people were, his own people were shocked, his own secretaries. He later told us that they said, you better not say that to the American president. That's a bad thing to say. He won't do like that, blah, blah, blah. But he insisted on saying that. And he gave talks in Europe, European Parliament, and here steadily that the 21st century cannot have major wars, that it has to be like a century of dialogue, and conflict has to be resolved through dialogue in all cases. And a lot of people, Richard Gere, after 9/11, at a rock concert for the victims of 9/11 here in New York, said that they shouldn't hate the terrorists and so forth, and was booed, completely booed off the stage.
Right.
And but he bravely said that. And so, but then there is a book. There are books, particularly I like Jonathan Schell's book called The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People, which is about the Eastern European freeing themselves from the Russian occupation without violence. And how that worked, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not from Gandhi, it's not from the Dalai Lama. So there are people who are very astute observers of the world and who say that the human habit of going to war over this and that, of having irreconcilable enmity, in other words, is essential to overcome on a broad scale or the world cannot survive. And also that these violent things don't work, actually. Nobody's been winning any wars,
right,
if you follow me. So, you know, people say to us about the Tibetan movement, the suffering of the Tibetan people under the Chinese genocidal occupation, they will say, well, what did the Dalai Lama achieve with that, with this nonviolence? Look at them, they're still getting wasted. But how about the violent people in Afghanistan? How about in the Middle East? Where are they going with all their 50, 60, 100 years of violence? They're not getting anywhere either. So the point is that Buddha, Jesus, Zoroaster, Confucius, Isaiah, they all taught us that some form of self-restraint, of some form of there's something higher than vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, the old Jewish prophet said. That means you don't have to go get vengeance because the Lord will take care of it. And so this is an ancient teaching that which is considered practical by those great people who founded forces in our cultures of the whole planet that are still alive to us. We're still trying to live up to them, and we're still failing.
Yeah.
But we've finally reached a point in history where we cannot fail, because the old way of, like, I'm going to crush down this enemy and then I'll be cool, is not working. And it clearly doesn't work. The weapons are too powerful. The world is too transparent. There's too much information. And so there has to be a mass effort of inner self-control. And I have a kind of theory about that. I call it cool heroism has to be evolved instead of hot heroism. Because we know that people as soldiers can be trained to be hot and be heroes in a violent way. But can we train ourselves to be cool and be heroes in a nonviolent way? And when I was challenged over that many years ago, I had a eureka moment where I realized, connecting to something Sharon just said, I realized that it isn't just the exceptional Dalai Lama and Tutu. Actually, Dalai Lama gave a speech recently in London where he scolded everybody in the audience in St. Peter's Basilica or something in London, saying, don't just depend on some hero. You have to do this work yourself if you want world peace and so on. He was talking. But what I'm saying is the women on this planet are the nonviolent heroes. They are doing it. They don't like their sons or husbands or fathers being killed in wars. And nowadays, they're daughters and sisters in some of the modern armies. They don't want that. They keep families together when the stupid men are out aggressing on each other. The brothers are beating each other up. The father and son are having Oedipal and post-Oedipal and anti-Oedipal struggle, whatever it is. And they absorb blows from both sides and say, you didn't mean that. You didn't really want to say that. You really love each other. They're the one who constantly do that. And they release oxytocin, and the neuroscientists say.
There you go.
They release oxytocin in their nervous system, seeking connection and not cortisol of wanting to be aggressive like the stupid males. And therefore, but why are we still having problems on this planet is there are broad zones of the planet, if not the whole one, where the women are still disempowered from making the powerful decisions. And the stupid men are still sitting there in their little tanks and with their little bombs, and they're running around with their little missiles, and they haven't really understood the deal of the century with Chevy Chase, like what it's all about, some stupid phallic nonsense of violence. And the women are still not having an equal say. I'm not saying they need to dominate, but at least they need to be equal. And the places of the worst disaster, population explosion, poverty, whatever, on the planet, are where world religions are misinterpreted. Everything is misinterpreted in such a way that women are crushed down and have absolutely no say and are having like 10 children or whatever, you know, like ridiculous business.
Let me ask you.
Love your enemy is what women have been having to do for thousands of years. And they are the ones living the teaching of Jesus and Buddha, et cetera, I think actually ultimately better than the men. And hopefully, even though the men have been more monks and you have a few important heroes and saints who are bucking the Rambo trend, but the Ulysses, you know, Achilles, Rambo trend. But now it's time.
Right.
That's what I have to say about it. I have no credibility to say it even. But that's what I say. And my wife appreciates that I say it, even though she won't quite give me an A+. I still have like a B-. B for my own personal habits are still those male entrenched habits. Till too much, but much improvement, actually. I'm an ex-monk, actually. And ex-monks make better mates and parents than non-ex-monks, generally. But that's just because I'm a hard case, probably.
Let me ask you this. Here in the 21st century, 13 years in, so many people in the West, and I mean, this is so interesting because I know the two of you were among those, the groups of people who in the 60s and 70s really kind of imported Buddhism in Eastern religions to the West for the first time. And now at this point, it really feels to me like there's this, you know, this critical mass of people exploring meditation, taking up meditation, yoga, you know, just I think even in the last 5 years is on every corner. Now, obviously, there's a real variety in the quality of all of that, you know, but there it is. It's there. And so many people are finding something in it. And I just want to ask the two of you about, let's say, one of the most kind of countercultural pieces of the ethos of that, which this tradition is bringing, you know, into Western lives, and it's such a contrast, Bob, to what you were just describing of the old way, and it's this kind of mystical idea that you can get in an ordinary yoga class or an ordinary meditation session in some inner city, that when you sit there and do this inward work of breathing and planting yourself in something, you know, that, you know, going back to that idea that infinite goodness, or dedicating your hour of yoga to other people, right? That somehow that mm-hmm. act, that what looks like a private act, does send something out into the world, does have an effect on the world. And I think that that's a pretty mysterious idea that a lot of people are just kind of taking in now and taking in seriously. So I'm curious about how you understand that. Does that make sense?
Do you want to say something?
Sure, I'll try. Well, I think, of course, one of the main ways that we send a different kind of energy out into the world is through our own actions and as we make different choices and we speak differently to one another. And we brought one of our teachers to America pretty soon after we had come back ourselves, this man named Manindra, and it was maybe a year or two after, and there was nothing compared to what's happening now,
right.
But there were some groups of people interested in meditation coming around as we went around the country, and we brought them around to see them, and we were kind of proud, like, isn't it exciting? You know, there are like 40 people
right.
in the country who are meditating,
right.
you know, something like that, and isn't it wonderful? And he said, oh, it is wonderful, and there's just this one thing. He said, sometimes people in the West remind me of people sitting in a rowboat, and with great sincerity and earnestness, they're rowing and rowing and rowing, but they refuse to untie the boat from the dock. He said, you know, sometimes I think people are mostly interested in these great transcendent experiences and altered states of consciousness, but they're not all that interested in how they speak to their neighbor or
right,
how they
right,
are with
right,
their children.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, so the most profound transformation happens within us and then ripples out because of how we are. It's like
right.
spirituality in
it's
our lives.
Still who you are
piece,
when you walk
you know?
Out of the room, you're saying.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You
yeah.
know, but I do think, you know, I mean, certainly in a traditional culture like Burma, if you do metta or loving kindness practice, they will say the most important transformation is within your own mind and it's an energy. It is like an energy that but it's like a gift, you know, that energy. It's like you can't insist someone like your gift. You
mm-hmm.
can't insist that
mm-hmm.
they put
right.
it on right away or say, that's the best book I've ever been given. Thank you. You know, it's
yeah.
All we can do is extend it. And there are times when, you know, it can make for some changes.
Mm. Yeah, I would add to that only briefly that my good friend Rupert Sheldrake has written a marvelous book. He wrote a bunch of good books before, but he recently wrote a marvelous book called Science Set Free here in the U.S., and in which, among other things, he elaborated his concept of morphic resonance, what he called. And this is a biological concept that he has developed by the study of the behavior of birds and monkeys, animals, and also fashion and things like that.
Is he a physicist, Rupert Sheldrake?
He's a biologist.
Biologist,
at Oxford.
Okay.
Oxford
right,
biologist.
Right,
but he's
right.
a little bit of a heretic from the high church of materialism.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Of Richard Dawkins and these kind of people.
Yeah.
Because he says that what we used to refer to in the 60s and still occasionally today, you know, vibrations, good vibrations, bad vibrations,
right.
that they vibrate and they are shared mm-hmm. between minds of people. And he calls it morphogenetic or morphic resonance, and to make it sound scientific, you know. But it just mm-hmm. means that if you have a change of heart in your own heart, and you have a tiny little, not even complete forgiveness, but a little ounce of forgiveness in a momentary thing about someone you don't like or someone you have harbor a grudge against, that sends out a vibration that is sensed by other people. Or like this guy, for example, he studied people who react to somebody else looking at them. And, you know, measuring various ways, clever ways, which people can feel it when somebody else is looking at them, staring at them.
Mm-hmm.
And then they turn and look. And, of course, regular scientists get really mad about it because they're bent on saying that the mind doesn't exist and that it's just the brain doing this and that. But yet, and, you know, he can make it sound biological, like it's like a prey animal knows when the predator is staring at it, you know, there's a tiger lurking there, the deer knows, so it runs away soon enough. And that develops an enhanced evolutionary possibility. You can do it in a materialist way for this concept of morphic resonance. But that's it. And the resonance that we have in this country now is basically a resonance where people are trying to break out of something that I think comes really from the originally Protestant ethos of America, the Protestant ethic, which is that you're not allowed to feel good. Why did they burn so many wise women over the centuries in Europe and here, who were women living in the fringe of the town? Maybe they weren't married. Maybe they knew something about the herbs. Maybe they didn't. They cured people's common cold. Maybe the animals liked them, and they had a couple of cats who were friendly with them. And then they freaked out. They felt good. They had a good feeling inside. And those uptight people went, and Puritans and others went and burned them, you know, because they feel good. It's supposed to be satanic if you feel good. We have a thing about you're not supposed to be happy. It's illegal to be happy. It's dangerous to be happy. People in these last few generations, not just the 60s, but even now, are demanding to be happy. Mm. And they're making a choice. Well, maybe I'm not armed. Maybe I don't have like 16 Uzi machine guns in my house. But, you know, I feel better. And I'm going to feel better. I'm going to go do yoga instead of going to the shooting range and blasting off there, shooting some terrorists or something in my mind. I'm going to go do yoga and I'm going to loosen up my nervous system to I can feel my inner good feelings that are streaming in my body all the time. I'm going to do that. And that's what's happening. And this movement is part of it. And I just want to say one thing. It is not a religious movement. I just want to emphasize that.
Right.
One of the reasons we're happy with our title is that we want to show that we are sharing with other people, with whatever religion. The reason Buddhism spread to so many different Asian countries that all had their different religions is that it didn't challenge their religions. It presented a psychological mind science and a philosophical, you know, scientific science that helped people manage better with their causes and conditions. And one of the things about it is not to be against their whatever their religious beliefs are. You know, within that, of course, different religions, like Jesus said, turn the other cheek. You could have some Christians who think they're supposed to kill some enemies who are not Christians. And, you know, they don't listen to vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. They think right. They are supposed to go out and do vengeance. But Jesus said, no, that's not good. I don't want you to do that. I'm not going to be nice to you if you go and kill people in my name, especially I don't want it. So there are different interpretations of the religions that when people feel better, they might change to some extent. But nobody's asking anybody to drop their religion.
Right.
On top of which, the Dalai Lama just wrote a book called Secular Ethics or Beyond Religions, yeah, in which he tries to elaborate something he calls secular ethics. He doesn't even insist that the you know, physical humanists, or what do you call it, humanistic materialists, that they change their view. They can be materialists if they want, as long as they're not dogmatic fanatics about it, mm-hmm, and despise people who are religious. His own inner feeling, Dalai Lama's, is that people with some spiritual idea that ultimately, somewhere under all the rhetoric and all the institutional oppression and whatever there is a positive energy in the universe. Those are more lucky people, actually.
Right, right.
But rather than that, there's just nothing there, you know. But at least nothing is at least not actively malevolent. It's just nothing. But positive energy being at the basis is a little more nice. So it's not a religious invasion. The bringing the infusion of the Asian civilizations in the formerly conquering West is a more of a cultural and a scientific and a psychological thing coming from people who were more wealthy actually in ancient Eurasian times than the West Asia was, and therefore were more into like having some kind of pleasure, had some kind of love. They were more relaxed with their women as a whole, especially India, you know, was like that. And so that's really what's coming out of India, and that is helping us. And and people shouldn't fear it as a religious, missionarization thing, because it is not that.
Yeah, I don't.
But the larger
that.
Population can get a little nervous about that.
Yeah.
So I want to be clear about that. So.
No, that's good. We need to finish. I feel like this has been just such a great, wide ranging conversation. Is there anything either of you would want to add? Anything you want to add, Sharon, to what Bob just said?
I want Sharon to have the last word.
I feel like I should praise Bob after he lavishly praised me and said, I love being with Bob.
Oh, well, that's nice.
He loves being with me.
Thank you, Sharon. That's good. That's really nice. And I, as you know, I love being with Sharon, and I love it that people are enjoying Sharon and hope they enjoy whatever we have been offering to them.
Yeah, well, this is...
And been very nice talking to you, and
yes.
It's too bad we have to stop.
I know.
Basically, we should be on the air for at least a day or two.
Exactly. Well, clearly.
You know, but I know it's not reality, so...